Been asked tonight to share on the topic of recruiting or selecting and training team leaders. Now, I tried to get from Harv late this afternoon exactly what level we're talking about, and I was already prepared, so it didn't matter what he said to me. So you'll just have to ask questions, and I'd like this to be an open feedback thing the whole time tonight, okay? If you start getting a little sleepy, we'll just stand up and take a little stretch. I just spent last weekend down in Las Cruces, and we had a Disciples Makers conference for two solid days, and I spoke seven times. I got two half an hours off. It was man-to-man all the rest of the time. And we just barreled straight through and just had a fantastic time going into the details of how you build from the disciple to disciple-maker level, which is the area that is a little more vague. You know, follow-up isn't so bad. And getting up to the disciple level is not too bad. But when you start getting fairly concrete in those other levels, it becomes a little bit more difficult. Now, whenever you talk about training or selection, there are more theories running around, more styles, more everything than you can possibly imagine. So you're always stepping on some pretty shaky ground anytime you go preaching about this. But you know the way I say, everybody's entitled to their own ideas, no matter how ridiculous they are. And we can, I think I read somewhere that you can have your own ideas if it's not the same as mine, just nobody will pay any attention to it. So you'll just permit me to go ahead and try and go through a few things with you tonight and give you a few ideas. You can glom on to one or two of them if they are helpful to you. And then ask questions, share with one another what you have learned, and we'll just muddle through it in that way. Okay, now, as I think of talking to you guys here, I realize that I'm talking to the people that are carrying the ministry load back there in the D.C. area. And you guys are up to your eyeballs in everything. And you are the ones who do the work, you select the men. Some people around think Harv does it, but I know different. I know you guys are out there scraping the grass and getting these people out and sharing the gospel. And in particular, most guys in Harv's position or mine have no opportunity to recruit anybody that you don't first get your hands on. Isn't that right, Harv? I mean, the fact is, you guys and the guys that work for you as team leaders and so forth are the ones who get the guys out. And then from there, you may be able to get some help in certain aspects of recruiting and disciple making. Now, unfortunately, you're probably loaded with activity. You're in one or two studies. You're leading a study. Have a fall conference, a spring conference, a trip like this, a one-day conference. You're a team leader. You're doing rallies and everything else. And probably some of your attitude is, when is this rat race going to end? And then when you think about the possibility of the rat race, you might be a little afraid that it might end. What would I do if it did end when all these activities go? One of the fellows who was working at the Air Force Academy with us for a number of years, Roger Brandt, I think some of you here know him, Mike, you know him, Dave. Roger went up to Canada, and out of the context of an AB ministry, and he said it was like stepping out into a vacuum for that first few months, with no one having the structure of the activity, no one having this thing to go to. Everything that happened had to be of his inception. And just in case, your life is built around the activities that are going on, which is awfully easy to do, I'd like you to take an hour or so sometime to think of what you would do if no one organized any activity for you. See, our NAV structure provides a tremendous framework for doing things. And unless you have been out in the boonies by yourself, and many of you I'm sure have, but you don't really realize how much momentum is there. And it's kind of like jumping in a stream and you just kind of get caught up with it. Well, it's kind of, you go out and you grab a few guys and you throw them in the stream and they get caught on. And one of the problems is we personally may not learn how to do certain things in the ministry. Now, I'd like to have you take just a moment, and you've got some notes there, or a piece of paper, and I'd like you to take 1 minute and just write down what your definition of a disciple maker is. I'm going to start on this basis and then move into some other things. While you're writing that down, I'm going to go back and get a cup of coffee. Okay, now let's just share a few items out of this, what is a disciple maker, your definition of a disciple maker. Can some just volunteer two or three? I just want to get a couple ideas here.
One who is leading people to Christ and influencing them to live a life that honors Christ.
Okay. Another one?
Man who makes a decision.
Okay.
The person who is effectively teaching and training someone to replace him.
Okay. Now, I'm sure that we come up with many things, and all of those are right answers, but I would like to emphasize one thing in particular to you about a disciple maker tonight, that first and foremost, a disciple maker is a disciple. And I think it's something that we must never lose sight of, is that in our own lives as disciple makers, that those characteristics of a disciple are being built in deeply. And that we are loving Christ, hating sin, walking in victory, obeying God. That you and I, in the process of disciple making, are living that life of a disciple. And as I recall, one of the profile points, that we're growing in those aspects of being a disciple. Now, I'm sure that a result of this conference is that many of you are just picking up one thing after another, from some of the messages anyhow, as I looked at the outline. Just ideas on disciple making. And of course, I would believe that a team leader is going to have to be a disciple maker. I'm not sure what your standards are. You work with who you've got, where you are. So obviously, it'll vary. But first of all, we have to help them be a convicted, and rather a disciple that has convictions and is doing things because God says, not because he is just in our system. And in our own lives, I really hate to speak on disciple making, and that's not exactly my topic tonight, but it's very close to it, without really putting pressure on us, you and me, that we have got to grow in those areas of the basics of our Christian life. And as we think of our own life, we have to look at what is our excuse for being around. Well, it's to grow into the image of Christ and then to multiply and to reproduce. And unfortunately, in many cases, we reproduce what we are. And people watch us, and they can sense whether we're just doing the ministry or whether we are living it. Whether it's our life or whether it's just our activity. Whether it's a performance or whether it's something you're doing out of the conviction of the Scriptures. And I remember getting up to Washington State College or Washington State University last fall, talking to a guy who'd been around the NAS for 5 or 6 years. He'd been in the military ministry and was around a collegiate ministry. And he went home because of some trouble in the family. And he told me, he says, all the basics just fell to pieces when he got out of the system. And he basically stopped doing them. And it was taking him 2 to 3 months to crank back up when he got back to the campus. Man, something tells me there that some of the things that we, quote, built in, aren't really built in. You know, we get to doing them mechanically, and you and I can relate to that because we've been in the same boat many times in the past. Now, I'd like you to take your Bible for just a moment, and I'm going to look at two passages with you. First is Psalm 72:78. I think many of you may have memorized this particular passage. 78, 72 maybe, like I say. Okay, so Psalm 78, 72 is speaking of David shepherding the people. It said he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. And I think as you go about bringing men in to positions of responsibility, that we want to be sure, cream and sugar. Lots of cream, a little bit of sugar. Pardon me. They can cut that out of the tape, can't they? That didn't relate to the message. That wasn't Psalm 78, 72. I often wondered if David had coffee. Okay, so the two items that David was involved with here, one is he shepherded them in two ways. One, in the integrity of his heart. He had the right motive for what he did. It came out of his inner life. He did it because of God's leading in his life. He did it not to for his own glory, or not to have a bunch of men around him, but he did it because of what God had put in his heart. And secondly, he guided them with his skillful hands. So I look at two aspects of those of you who are recruiting men into positions of leadership and are going to count on them and train them, is that we have to do it out of the integrity of our own heart. I was sitting this afternoon going over the regional strategy. And, you know, I started crossing names and jiggling them around and doing all the stuff you do when you're trying to figure out how to put the whole thing together 2 or 3 years down the road, people moving, going overseas, and all this. And a funny feeling came over me. I'd forgotten some names. I said, good night, we don't have very many names here. You know, what's happened to all these people? But in my heart, you know, there's a little bit of a panic. How are we going to do it? But down deep inside, I could sense that thing. What are people going to think if we can't man these? And I said, you know, that is not the right motive. You know, God has to prick my own heart. We don't bring people onto the staff. We don't do anything just to get numbers, or just so someone can see that we can build something up. But somehow, we have to be able to do this in the integrity of our heart, because God has laid it on our hearts. And secondly, that we do it skillfully, knowing what we're doing. And I have operated in times past out of my hip pocket so many times that it almost becomes second nature. Now, there are a lot of people who are very good at operating out of their hip pocket in the disciple-making business, but it's very difficult for them to ever pass anything on to someone else. It is not a pass-onable skill. Now, in the process of thinking things through for this message and for the ones that I shared in last weekend, we got into this idea of reproduction. And some of the questions... Thank you. Some of the questions that came up as we went through this whole business of multiplication. Now, see, any guy who uses his head a little bit starts counting the 40th anniversary of the Navigators, starts going through these illustrations of the checkerboard and so forth, and then starts counting the address list or something and says, you know, what's happening? You know, is this multiplication thing a myth? And in fact, I had some very embarrassing questions asked last weekend. A couple of very, very sharp guys, you know, they'd get, when I'd have man-to-man with them, and I went through all the stuff we were going to do man-to-man, says, you know, I've been hearing this now for 2 or 3 years, but nobody's done this with me. You know, is this a myth, something you talk about and don't do? Or we get into this area of reproduction. Well, do we really believe that the Bible teaches this? And there are many times that we use verses, perhaps out of context, to say the things that we want to say. So I got down a couple weeks ago and went into this matter of reproduction and tried to go through another biblical study on the aspect of reproduction, and to make sure that what I was communicating was what the Bible really said. And so one thing I'd like to do tonight is to share with you a little of that Bible study on reproduction. The reason that I want to share this is reproduction to me is the key of selectivity. Okay, now we're talking about selection and training. Okay, now when I select, what I am going to select on the basis of, that is for team leaders at that level, are those men who have the greatest potential for reproduction. So that's why I say it's one of those keys. So if I'm going to start putting my money on that key, then I better be doing something that's biblical and not something that just kind of comes out of history. Okay, so let's just think about that. Now let's think of what it is. Well, there are many questions that come up. One is it biblical or navigator, this business of reproduction? Second question is, can I personally reproduce? I'm sure many of us just think about that, and we look at what we're doing, and so we ask ourselves that. Another question that's been asked many times is, can everyone reproduce? Can any man anywhere reproduce? And then, is reproduction the same as multiplication? And then, of course, how can I ensure in the man with whom I am working that he will reproduce? Well, you know, if we had the perfect answer to all those questions, we'd really be, we'd be able to market a new book in the Navigators. It'd be number 9 also on the bestseller list, like Doss is. Okay, let me just go through a little thing here with you. Okay, now, you always start in reproduction with you. Okay, and you help another man here, and you start building into his life. Now, as I got to thinking of reproduction and multiplication, you know, and I ran myself dizzy trying to think through the fourth or fifth generation. You know, can I ensure the fourth or fifth generation from me? And I got to the idea that I can't. I can ensure the second generation, me being the first, right? You really have got a handle on that, don't you? I mean, if you're working with a man and you are reproducing, you can really work with that. Okay? Secondly, through that man, it generally is not too difficult to work one more generation. Okay, at this point, just for the sake of argument, and boy, this thing's about as, you know, solid as warm mud in all of the thinking I'm going through on this. And my basic purpose is try to define what multiplication is without going through all the little tricks. You know, 1, 2, 4. Now, see, I know that illustration gives us a tremendous power in geometric progression. But I'm down on the level where in Colorado Springs we work with a guy, and we try and get him going, get him reproducing, and then to help one other guy. And so Kerry Taylor roars out to the academy, and he starts talking to the guys down at that third level. And we start finding out what's really happening. And sometimes what we think is happening is not. You almost wish you hadn't gone and looked, because you had such good ideas. The numbers look so good. Let me give you an example. For instance, this year already, we've had 100 men receive Christ at the Air Force Academy. That's not so unusual. We did last year, too. But as we go through those lists, year after year, we see a pretty significant drop-off rate. Are you guys experiencing that in your ministries also? You know, those lists from the previous year. And so you finally say, now wait a minute. What are we really doing? Okay, now let's just try this one on for size. Okay, you help this other man, lead him to Christ, or build him up. Okay, let's call this reproduction. Okay? That first generation is you have reproduced. Now, when this next man leads another guy, one or two, whatever it is, but let's just work on one, I'm going to say that then we have started the process of multiplication. And say that if I do my job right with this man and through this man to this man, I have then put the best insurance I can get on multiplication. Now, if I start roaring down the road and work only on the basis of multiplying evangelism, for instance, and so we get a bunch of other X's down here, it may not be multiplication unless we are going through with each of these to a point of discipleship. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. So right now, let me just define multiplication as that business of going to the third generation. Now the key is, though, having done the job right at that point, and that you didn't cheat and go around this guy and do the training of this man yourself, that you really worked through this guy and you helped him know how to pass things on. Okay? Right now, I can think through that far and I can see that we can ensure it. Okay, now let's talk about a biblical basis for reproduction. Okay, now let's look at Genesis 1:28. Would somebody look that up, please? Genesis 1:28. Okay, now someone else look up Deuteronomy 4, 9, and 10. Okay, would you read Genesis 1:28, please?
And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over every living thing that moves on the earth."
Okay, we see in nature, and we could use many illustrations of this, that the law of nature is reproduction. In every single realm, there is no realm that I know of in the biological world where reproduction is not the law. You can find nothing that I know of in the biological areas that does not reproduce, or else you wouldn't see it today. Okay, so it's a law of nature. Okay, but now can I extend that to the law, that law of nature, to something spiritual? Because I can't just take the Old Testament and spiritualize it. Well, let's go on just a little further. Read Deuteronomy 4, 9 and 10.
"Take heed and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children, how on the day that you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, the Lord said to you, 'Gather the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children so.'"
Okay, so here we have the principle, at least within the family, that we're to guard certain things and pass them on not only to our sons, but also to our grandsons. Now, at least within the context of the family, we can say that reproduction was not only physical, but was what else? What else from that verse? Well, it was spiritual, at least knowledge and belief and so forth. So from this, we find that at least within the family, we have a pretty good justification for reproduction, not only physically, but spiritually. Okay, if you turn over a couple of pages to Deuteronomy 6, and you can look at it's a similar passage, but in 6, 4 through 9, the famous verse of Judaism, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons, shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way," and so forth. And it goes on down, write them on the doorposts, and so on. So it tells about, again, a spiritual process of teaching the sons. Now, the problem now is, can I extend this into the New Testament, and then can I say that what is taught back here in the Old Testament of spiritually passing on to our sons and our sons' sons, can I apply that spiritually now? See, I could preach you a sermon out of this, couldn't I, today? I could gin it up and do that. But if I want to be careful on this, I must go just a little bit further. So now I'm going to move into the New Testament. And the third thing that I'm going to go to is the Great Commission in Matthew 28. Okay, and there we find that we are to go out into all the world and we are to make disciples of all nations. Okay, now that's just the Great Commission, you know that. So that is the capstone of Christ's command. So no matter what was done in the Old Testament, Christ had the prerogative of overriding it if he wanted to. And he did some things. He replaced circumcision went out of existence, and various other things went out of existence at the point of Christ's coming, Christ's death, resurrection, the new covenant, and so forth. So now you have to go to this capstone of Christ's ministry, the Great Commission. Now to find out what was meant by the Great Commission, you have to move on into the Acts and the Epistles. See, we can try and interpret everything in the Gospels, but basically the Acts is the outworking of what Christ said and told them to do, and the Epistles is the explanation by Paul and some others of why they did what they did, and putting a foundation on it. So if we move on a little bit further, and we want to find out now how they used in the New Testament the word sons in a spiritual sense. Do any of you know 3 John 4? Someone quote that, Johnny?
Have no greater
joy than you get with your children. Okay, so the Apostle John used the term children spiritually, if you look in that context. So he refers to his spiritual children. Okay, then if you go to 1 Corinthians 4:17, who can quote that to me? 1 Corinthians 4:17. Someone's got to have that one. For though you have 10,000 instructors in Christ, yeah, behold, I have begotten you. Okay, so Paul used the term fathers and sons in a spiritual sense also. How about Colossians 3:16? And Colossians 1:28. Okay, would somebody just look it up or quote those for me, please? Colossians 3:16.
Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing with grace and hearts.
Okay. So there's that idea of teaching others, having an influence, just like one would with your own children. To others, but inside the body of Christ. And Colossians 1:28 is presenting every man perfect in Christ. So how they interpreted the Great Commission, in one sense, they went through and said, we're to bring people up to some point of discipleship to help them grow, and then we are to, they refer to them as sons, and I think then we can follow through from the Old Testament, and this is just a very much a brief on this, but you can follow through from the Old Testament right on through and show how reproduction was looked upon both in the New Testament and the Old Testament. It was looked upon in a spiritual sense that it is a right way to go and that it ought to go more than one generation. Because the family, when it's talked of in the Scriptures, never includes just one generation. That's Western in our thinking. The family is usually run by the grandfather in most Eastern cultures. Or maybe even the great-grandfather, and he has the responsibility. And so as we interpret things in the family here, we want to make sure that we realize that it probably means several generations. Okay, we could go into a number of other things, and I'm going to skip them. Let's say what Paul did. He taught children, and then he taught Timothy to teach someone else, and he passed things on like this in the 2 Timothy 2:2 sense. And you can say, okay, should we follow Paul's example? According to Philippians 3:17 and many other passages, he said, follow my example. Do like I do. And so I came to the conviction again that, yes, reproduction is biblical. It is the pattern of Scriptures. It is the law of nature. And that unless we reproduce after our own kind, then we are not fulfilling God's plan. And reproduction is not just one generation, but is on for several generations. The only difference, and I think we picked this up back in Deuteronomy, in this word, guard these things, is that physically, reproduction will go on, perhaps unhealthily, just automatically. But in the spiritual sense, it will not continue automatically. Or will it? You know, when we think of reproducing spiritually, we think of it healthily, don't we? But you reproduce what you are, don't you? There's an illustration that I read recently of a guy that was called in the middle of the night by a lady, a neighbor, who didn't have a way into town. And she asked if he would please get up and drive them at 6 a.m. to take her little crippled child to the hospital. It was 50 miles away. He didn't want to go, but he had no way to say no. So the woman carried the child to the car the next morning, put him down in the driver's seat, and mumbled thanks through her tears, and Joe said everything would be okay and drove off. And the little kid, after a mile or so, looked up and says, you're God, aren't you? And he said, well, no, I'm afraid not. I'm not God. And he says, well, I thought you must be God because last night Mother prayed and asked that God would get us to the hospital so I could get well and play with other people. And he said, do you work for God? And the guy said, well, sometimes I guess, but not very regularly. But I think I'm going to try a little harder from now on. You know, it started getting to him. But the point of it is that we really do represent God here, and we really do represent what we are down deep inside, or reproduce what we are down deep inside. And so we reproduce by our life. And I think that is the key to selecting anybody, is that they will reproduce what they are. I don't care what method you give them. I don't care what neat things they know in the ways in the way of theory. They will basically reproduce like they are and like you are. And that's kind of a scary thing. And so that really, to me, puts the B and says, now, Jerry, you had better be walking with God. Just today, I lined up to start meeting with a guy, a faculty member out at the Air Force Academy, and it really puts the bee on me. We're starting right at follow-up and going to start going how he'll help another guy. And I know this guy is very smart and very sharp, but we're going to start over right at the beginning. And we're going to start going over his assignment for this week, is when we meet early Wednesday morning, is to just work out what he would do, what topics he'd cover, and follow up with a brand new Christian. Then we'll go into each of those with ourselves. What are we doing? And just start right at scratch. I could go and assume a lot of things about this guy. But if I assume them, then he will do exactly the same thing when he starts helping someone else. And of course, my purpose is that he'll help someone else, because he can have a tremendous influence out there on the faculty, and he'll probably be here for 3 or 4 more years. So we want to be very careful that we do not skip steps in building in people's lives. Okay, now let's talk for just a few minutes about selection. And I'd like you to turn, if you would please, to Exodus 18. Now, whenever we talk about selection, most of us think about selecting certain people out. You know, we're not going to work with you. See, that's the way it comes across so many times. But I really don't think we ought to think that way. We ought to think of who we are going to select in to draw in close to ourselves to work with in an in-depth basis. I think that selection is taught throughout the Scriptures. And I believe that there is no spiritual work that is going to go on and is going to be successful without the proper selection of the men that you impart responsibility to. Okay, now in Exodus 18, we find the circumstance where Moses was trying, remember he was trying to judge all the people, all himself, and he'd go from morning to night and they'd bring all their little stuff, the arguments between the families and the divorces and this and that and the other thing. And it was just wearing him out. And his father-in-law, Jethro, was there, and he chewed him out and said, what you are doing is wrong. And so Jethro started giving some counsel. And we start in verse 13. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone? Alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning till evening. And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and make known the statutes of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you are doing is not good. And that to me is really something, because what was there about what Moses was doing that was not good? He was teaching them what God said. He was making peace between people. He was helping everybody. He had an open door. He let everybody come in, from the most serious case to the worst case. And he helped everybody who came around. What's wrong with that? It looks fine. Nothing that Moses was doing was outwardly wrong, because he was dispensing rightful justice. But what was his problem? Pardon me? He was doing it alone. It was as though he were the only one who could communicate to God. He wasn't training anybody else. And besides that, had he kept it up, he'd have probably dropped dead. And he would not have been able to do perhaps what God had called him to do. So he goes on and said, "You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk, and the work they are to do." Now, as I see that, God, Moses as the leader and representative of God. Okay, now you as a leader where you are, okay? You get with God and get his heart. And then in your Bible studies and public meetings, you share the principles that the Lord is giving you, and you preach and you make known those things which people can do to have a walk with God. Make known here the statutes and the judgments. And then he goes on and says this, "Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and let them judge the people at all times." Okay, now let me go back to a few key items in those two verses that I think lay some principles for selection. Okay, first of all, notice that it was a command to select. He had to go in, and Moses had to make a judgment. And any time he selected, it meant one person, it meant he did not select someone else. Isn't that right? There is no way around that. If you go in and select, then you will automatically not choose someone else. Now, some people cannot live with that. They think, if I can't treat everybody exactly the same, then I'm doing an injustice. And this is why in many churches, we get hung up when we start this discipling bit. Because if there's a program, it's got to be available to everybody. And unfortunately, in our NAB ministry, sometimes we do that also. Now, did Moses use a volunteer system? No, he did not. He knew these people, he'd observed them, and he went in and selected on certain bases. First of all, they were able. Now, remember in 2 Timothy 2:2, what were the two characteristics of the man that was to be chosen? Faithful and able. Okay, as you go through that little study in 2 Timothy, you find the word able in 2 Timothy 2:2. Then over later, you find out some other qualifications, and a man is to be apt to teach. And that word apt and the word able are very, very similar. And I believe it means the man is not only qualified to do something, that is, he knows how to do it, he is gifted, but when he has the opportunity, he will do it. And you know, that one, like for instance, when I see my little 5-year-old, I have 4 children, and I've got an example for about everything now, it seems, out of it. But you take the 5-year-old and you set a piece of candy. If I set it in front of her, I would say, you know, she's just apt to take and eat that. And I'd say, apt? You know, boy, she really is gonna. See, the word apt used in that sense means she not only can, but will, given the opportunity. So to have a person who's gifted, but won't do anything, is of no good to you whatsoever. So I put to this word able that the person is gifted, and when he has the opportunity, he will do it. He will apply his gifts. So therefore, I see that a man has to have the ability. And now we'll talk in a few minutes about what abilities you might look for a team leader. Okay, the second thing that this person was supposed to do is that he was supposed to fear God. Okay, where am I? Okay, yeah, men who fear God. So that this man has a walk with God, and he has a right relationship with God. Do not choose a man just because he's gifted. I have a guy right now down in Albuquerque, and he is probably one of the most brilliant and gifted young guys that I've ever seen. He's 21, He's already working on his PhD, and he's going to get a PhD at age 23 and an MD at age 25. He's discipling guys. He's evangelizing the football team. He's into four languages, two fluently and two pretty good, and a fifth he can handle, and has on his heart to go to Eastern Europe. But I don't care how gifted this guy is, until I am convinced that he is walking with God and he's maturing and can use those abilities in the proper way, then I am not going to tap him on the shoulder. So we're willing to have him sit down there and wait for 4 years. You know, when I talked with him last Sunday night, or last Saturday night, I guess it was, a week ago, there was just the idea, might as well stay there, and we'll get you out of there in 2 or 3 years. You keep walking with God, and you keep doing your thing, leading people to Christ and discipling some guys, and we'll just bring them along gradually and get him involved in some training. And so I'm starting to plan out not how we'll use his great abilities, but how we are going to build that foundation deep in his life before we use it. But if you try and get someone to do something for which they are not gifted, it's just beating your head against a brick wall. And let's not do it, because we'll be out of God's will. Okay, now it says, men of truth. And I tried to think of, what does that mean, men of truth? And as I thought about that, I tried to think, now, why would he have this as a prerequisite of someone who is leading someone else? Well, there are two things that I could think of that could mean, men of truth. One is that this person was a man of the word. You know, a man of truth. Thy word is truth. But the second is that this person was objective. See, he would stand for what was right regardless of his emotions. And he wouldn't let his emotions override his judgment. And so I want to select a man who's not only gifted, who not only has a walk with God, but a man who is, I believe, a man of the word and is objective-oriented. He is not going to be running off on 10,000 different things. Every time I turn around, he's crashing off some other wall with some great idea, or he makes emotional judgments. And men, one thing you'll have to work on is being objective. Now, that doesn't mean being cold. It means being truthful. That's a big difference, isn't it? You know, many times we think of the objective person, you know, click, 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 you know, slice, chop, you know, objective. Well, that's not what I mean. I mean he's a man of truth. He handles men and circumstances honestly. He doesn't try and cover things up. He doesn't try and dress them up in some way that they are not. And he has a right view of other people. As we go on in this, we find out that those who hate dishonest gain, and boy, I think this is key, they have the right motive for leadership. In some sense, and I hate to use this one, this illustration, it's been told me that one who wants to lead is not qualified to lead. I have a hard time with that, because leadership is a gift. There is a gift of ruling. But yet the motive down deep inside is, why do I want to lead someone else? And boy, every one of us sitting in this room have got to grapple with this problem. You know, what kind of problems and pride do we have that we're here in this bunch? That you are chosen to come along. That you've been given responsibility. And every one of you know what's happened when you've been tapped for something and you say, aha, I must be getting up the ladder a little bit. Or somehow you interpret things in that way. And we have to really guard our hearts that our motive for being in a position is right before God. And as you go into the study of leadership, we see that the leader is to serve. So is your motive to serve people? And do you see this characteristic in those you choose to be a team leader, one who wants to serve them? Now, there are people who may have a gift of serving and may not necessarily be a leader. But that the way they use their abilities in leading is not self-serving. Man, I have gone through so many deals in battling my own heart. You know, I'd be in some little meeting, and my thought is, instead of how can I minister is the thought, well, I wonder who sees me. Or I wonder who knows what I do. Or I wonder who recognizes. You know all that stuff that you go through in your heart? Boy, it's just a clue that the seeds of death are there. And every one of us has got them there. They never die because they're part of the old man. And no matter where you are put in the ministry, you must always be crucifying that old man, and especially that little root that keeps popping up every other day in the business of being proud of one's position or proud of one's gifts. When it says in Romans 12, to have a sane estimate of yourself, that means just that. You're not to downgrade yourself or upgrade yourself, and you are to recognize that the gifts you personally have are from God. And you are to recognize those gifts that you do not have. I think one of the most difficult things that we have to deal with in the NAB ministries, and I think I can speak directly with you guys here, and one of the most direct the things is that we give the impression that unless a person is with us, and maybe even in our staff, that he somehow is not quite there. And boy, that's heresy. I mean, that is just not Bible. But we're such a dynamic outfit. We roar along so fast, and we give the challenges so hard that we do give that impression. And so in many ways, if, you know, for all of us here, we've got to say that that is not the key thing. But it's to be where God wants us, with the gifts God has given us, doing what God wants us to do. Okay, now notice on here in verse 21, the men who hate dishonest gain, and then you shall place these men over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Now, it's key to me, men, that every man did not have the same responsibility. Isn't that fantastic? But yet the requirements were the same. Isn't that an interesting thing? That it seems to me that the requirements were the same for the man who was over the tens as well as the man who was leader of thousands. I do not see in here whether or not the other person was older, more experienced, more gifted, or whatever. It seems that they had this set of requirements, but then Moses was not told to poll them and say, where do you want to go? But said, now place them. And so Moses went and he placed them carefully. Some of you have got a little team of one or two. Some of you have got a big team. Some of you got this, that, the other thing. And there's such a tendency, whenever you get together, is we to compare ourselves among ourselves. And of course, this is sin. We know that. But yet, we run into that. But this is really a blessing to see this, is that Moses placed them. That shows me the position of leadership. So Harv has a responsibility to know what you want, to know what your gifts are, and so forth. But knowing that, to place you. Now, you can reject it. But yet that responsibility is there. And then as we go on, in verse 22, and this is interesting, having selected, having met the qualifications, and then having placed them, what does it say in verse 22 that he was supposed to do? Yeah, let them do it. Let them do it. Don't go and do it for them. You've got to give them enough rope to either hang themselves or get out of the canyon. And they'll do one or the other. But you've got to let them do it. And some of us have the tendency in leadership to keep such a tight rein on this thing. And then we call that training. You know, and what it is we've just boxed them in so that they couldn't make a mistake if they wanted to. And so now we're starting to get over into this training of team leaders. But basically, when you put a man out and you give him a responsibility, you've got to let him do that job. You may correct him and rebuke him later, but you've still got to let him do it. And so that was interesting. I think Moses needed that. He, after doing this all himself for so long, he had to let them do it. Boy, it was one of the hardest things for me when in my last year at the Air Force Academy, I turned over the ministry to Roger Brandt. And Leroy told me, he says, now what you want to do is get out of there. And don't mess around. Let him have it. So for 2 months, the beginning of the year, I didn't go to any meetings. And I remember one night I was sitting in my kitchen doing some dumb thing on my kitchen table, and they were just 100 yards away at Roger's house meeting in a planning session for the Academy Ministry. Now, what am I doing sitting here when they're over there? You know, and you just have to kind of grab the table and stay and not diddle around until things really got off the ground. And that's what I did. And boy, it really worked well. But Leroy gave me some wise counsel. He said, now, you've got to give him that ministry. And so when you select someone and give them a job, you've got to let them do the job. Now, if you give them a job that's too big for their training, then that's your problem. You know, you have improperly selected. Okay, let's stop there for just a minute. And let me open it up for a little bit of questions in the area of selection. I know I haven't covered everything, but I may not be scratching where it itches in this area of selecting team leaders. So let me just hold up here. Yeah.
Two questions. I get you a hot dog
problem. Mm-hmm. In a minute.
So I'm doing that, you answer this one.
Okay.
This idea of placing the leaders.
Yes.
I've been talking to another staff, and some other staff had the same idea. Instead of grouping this bunch of people together and say, okay, leader, this is your team, you know, go do the battle. He said, you know, here's a bunch of guys, leaders, see if you can recruit some and make that your team, go do the battle. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Okay, make sure I understand what you're saying here, that you're saying just you gather these guys together and say, here's your leader, go do it. Is that? Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's an ineffective way. See, I doubt if Moses went down and got a guy out of the tribe of Benjamin and took him over to Judah and say, you run that little outfit. See, I don't think he did that. I think they came up from the midst of the men among whom they were living. So basically, the placing probably wasn't that difficult a circumstance, you know, at that point in time. They came up around the men that were already. And as someone who says, how do you, I think it was Henry Ford was asked, how do you choose leaders? And he says, well, that's a very simple question, he says. It's kind of like saying, who should sing tenor in the quartet? Well, obviously the man who can sing tenor. He says, the man who can lead is the man you put in leadership. And so you start seeing that come up through. And I would say he should come up basically through the midst of the men that he has instead of inheriting a team. Now, there are times where you, especially in the military ministries, where you will have the placing and in the inherited team bit. And I think we just have to live with that circumstance. It's second best. Does that help a little bit? But it's the second best way. Ken?
In 2 Timothy 2:2, in the last of those three things, it says that this man who will be able to teach others also. Is there a significance to the will be able? Is it a future thing? Or does he have to be able to teach already? Or is that something that we see a ways down the line?
I think it speaks in terms of potential in one way. But let me share a bit of heresy with you. In 2 Timothy 2:2, as we studied this again last year, that it basically, to me, is a verse on selection rather than a verse on multiplication. Because the basis of 2 Timothy 2:2 was what was taught in 2 Timothy chapter 1, which had to do with guarding the doctrine. And there were certain truths that were entrusted. And so Paul's great concern in 2 Timothy 1, he goes down through all these things and says, guard the doctrine, these sound words, keep them, and so forth. And then he says to Timothy that he is to commit those things to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Now, in the context, I have to say what he was talking about there was the doctrine that was included. Can I trade you?
Yeah.
That was included in chapter 1. So it was a special selection for special men, and it was to be passed on in a certain manner. And so it speaks more of selecting the right men than it does of a multiplication or even a four-generation process. And so, yeah, I think that one that, you know, faithful men who will be able, I think there's a matter, there gives ground for training in that. I'd have to check the Greek tense there to really know, you know, how future that was. But I believe that it does have the matter. You can do it. But they have to have that potential of doing it. Okay, some other questions on selection.
Like you stared at your statement, you select because of the potential of reproducing. So actually, like 2 Timothy 2:2, may emphasize selection, but it's for the finished product of reproducing.
Yeah. Yeah, see, now I would say that when I make a selection, that it'll be on the basis of a man's gift, but it will also be a base that I feel he has the best chance of reproduction. Now, let me go down into this business of selection for a minute. In evangelism, do you select?
Select where you evangelize.
Okay, you select where you evangelize. So in some ways we do, but you don't consciously refuse to evangelize somebody, do you? If you're in an area. There may be people you say, well, I don't, and that's one of our problems of follow-up, by the way. You know, you say, oops, if I lead this guy to Christ, I got to follow him up. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, some of the things we do restrain our evangelism, which I think is unfortunate. Because, man, we want to get people into the kingdom. Okay, but now in follow-up, for people that come to know Christ, you select who you follow up. Well, it depends on how many, but basically we don't talk selection in the area of follow-up. A great deal. Because a person comes to know Christ and he's got to grow just like anyone else, and he is, he is as much of an individual before God as anyone else. But now, when you start getting to the discipling process, that's where I believe your selection comes into play. Now, the scriptures speak of four levels of people. It speaks of babes, children, young men, and fathers. Right? I think we can somewhat categorize those four kinds of people spiritually. I think the Apostle John uses those as spiritual terms. He did in 3 John, so I think he also does in 1 John. So the babes, we follow up the babes. And the children are growing into discipleship, which I can equivocate or make an equivalent to young men. And then the young men grow into mature reproducers, fathers. Okay, now when I make a breakoff point after follow-up for a person who is committed to discipleship, and at that point I want to do some selection. Because then I am entering into a more difficult process, and if I don't do the selection job there, right. And I want to warn you, at that point, if you only put your emphasis on faithful and not able, you will end up in the end with men who may not be able. Because you'll find men who find their security in our kind of an outfit. See, because we are accepting. We don't put people down. And in both collegiate and military ministries, you'll find guys that will hang around because we will accept them. And we want that. We want to have an open fellowship and one in which people really feel loved. But those people will often be very, very faithful. Because it's through faithfulness that they find acceptance. But they may not be able to go on and to reproduce. So I just want to put out a little warning on that. That don't put all your money on faithfulness. Because there are some men who may not be very faithful, primarily because they have no reason. I see no reason to be faithful just because, you know, if I'm a young Christian and someone walks up and tells me to do this, this, and this, and I say, baloney to you, and spit in your eye. You know, I don't know, why should I do that? So, and then the idea comes across, well, if you want to be a part of what we're doing, you got, well, I don't know that I do want to be a part of what you're doing. I don't understand it. So what we refer to as unfaithfulness may simply be an honesty at times in some early stages of growth. And I would much rather work with a guy who gives me a little bit of guff and who pushes me to the limit on a lot of things, if he's honest in it, and then who also is gifted, and then get that guy to be yielded to God than to a guy who just does every single thing that I say because he wants to please me. Because when that guy leaves me, he'll probably do anything everybody else says. I know that's coming kind of hard on some of those things, but can I open that up for a question for just a little bit? Is that Johnny?
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me, Harv, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just a comment on this, on the same line of thinking. A lot of times we can misread loyalty, for instance, for insecurity.
We yeah.
think a guy is really loyal, where really he's insecure.
Yeah.
And it's very important that we read that right. Is he really loyal or is he insecure? And the same thing on this faithfulness thing.
Mm-hmm.
He may be faithful because he's a maladjusted outcast to society. And the mm-hmm. society won't accept him. So he'll do anything to be retained by the team.
That's right. You know, we must not lose our compassion in the midst of this. You know, and just be cold and hard and cutting. But we must recognize when a man is doing what Harv has just shared. Yeah, Harv, one other point.
We're talking about selecting a man to college.
Sure.
We're talking about selecting men from for training. So
right.
It isn't to the exclusion of.
Very much to be emphasized. That's correct. Yes, Johnny? Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. I wasn't even. That's good. I forgot about it. Oh, it's just very bright. I was going to write some other stuff down, but I got off on another tangent. Okay, yeah.
What are some things that we can look for so that we can tell the difference? You mentioned this is a responsibility we have to be able to tell the difference. What are there some obvious things?
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was thinking along the same lines. If we could, or if you could speak to that, at the two different levels, particularly at follow-up level,
okay.
Then we actually look for things in a follow-up level, not to train in for training, but in our observance of men and their progress. And then in the stage of the disciple, what are we watching for there?
Mm-hmm.
That will determine our picking of men.